factor three areas were created. Didn't solve the problem, and it went on. And Mannheim later had a confrontation with French, the French Italian. I was still having problems. Austin and I were having problems with the languages down until the very end. They calmed down some, but there were some long-lasting problems. The people developed personal hatreds when they weren't promoted, or or things of that sort. And they pointed their fingers on individuals who had done to them. Some of these fields are and quarrels about where they should be assigned in one department or another. Should they be in French or should they be in Spanish? Should they be in French or German? And so on. A lot of very bitter bickering went on. I don't know how we got on to that. Well, Dame Jack Ament was one of the chairs and stood for associate dean, and I was chosen. So he served for a time. Bob Henderson and I stayed on. Bob was more or less committed to leave. Bob never accepted a 12-month appointment. He remained on a faculty appointment with a special summer session stipend so he could get sabbatical leaves, which he considered one of the things that were good about being an academic. And he went off on leave for a year and was replaced by Stevens, who was the associate dean now in the School of Natural Sciences, and then came back and served, I think, a year with me as acting dean. Maybe he was away when Mannheim was dean. I've forgotten. But anyway, he went away for a year because of sabbatical and then came back. So we had a temporary person there for a year. Then Jack Almond died. That was when Jerry Mannheim was dean, however. The first phase of the... You want to know all the changes?
Well, just...
All right.
It doesn't have to be exact, but just
well,
whatever you...
Yeah, well, Hyde and Cox, I think it indicated from the early days that he considered one served for a period of time and then returned, and then would go to the classroom. I think that was probably his intention always, but I'm not absolutely sure. He reacted very negatively to Horn when he was appointed and when he came, and I don't know as I understand the basis for their ill feeling, but he developed quite a dislike for Horn. I think he decided he didn't want to serve under him. And so he resigned earlier than I think he intended. He might have stayed on, too, if he'd have been, found the position more congenial. So, with his, I think he served 4 years, and then he resigned. I decided that I would be candidate for dean again. Again, I was a runner-up, I think. It's one of the recommendations of the committee, at least. But President Horn chose Jerry Mannheim as an outsider. I think he had a feeling that outsiders would be better somehow. And I think somewhere along the line, President Horn had a feeling, he developed a negative feeling towards me. I don't know exactly why, but I know he did. I don't remember any run-in with him or anything specific that could have led to it, but I don't think he would have appointed me dog catcher if he had, complete freedom and option of having another viable candidate. I may be wrong about that, but...
When the job of dog catcher comes open,
we'll know. Yeah, we'll see. But anyway, he did ultimately appoint me acting dean and also associate vice president, technically, but these were really appointments of Goodman Melman and Adamany, I think. rather than his own. I don't think he'd have made the same appointments. But when Jerry was selected, there's a funny story connected with that. Choice of who would be the dean hung on into the summer, and I went off on vacation. And when I was up in Oregon somewhere, the Highway Patrol of Oregon got a hold of me and say I was to call back here and call President Horn. So I got on, I thought, well, my God, you know, as he decided to appoint me dean of all amazing things. When I got on the telephone, it was to simply tell me he was going to appoint someone else, which was nice, except the Highway Patrol had to run me down in order to tell me this. I remember I called him from Crater Lake. And he said, what would my reaction be, and would I continue, would I be willing to serve as an associate dean I hadn't seen his papers or anything, but I'd heard good things about him. I said, well, sure. I had mixed feelings in applying and so on. So I stayed on as associate dean. And then I think the next change was that Jack Ament died. And an appointment had to be made at that in that position. And it was then that Jerry Manheim appointed Jim Robinson. I must say, against the advice of his other associate deans, who were not impressed with his record or with him. But he'd been among the candidates, and he decided to appoint him. Well, Jim Remenson never really got on with any of the rest of us very well, or even with Jerry. He was one of the few people that I really found I couldn't get along with. I don't know why. We didn't hit it off at all. He took the view that I was doing things that he should do, and he asked me to look at papers and things. I'd lend him things, and I'd ask for them back, and he wouldn't give them to me, keep them. And other things like that just seemed rather strange. We got, by that time, into arguments over ethnic studies, which he sort of wanted to take control of, and I thought that the budgeting for them was like the budgeting of other programs and should be with Henderson, and the curriculum should be with me, and he had the personnel, and that was that. But he didn't see it that way. So we really had a lot of friction from the very beginning. Henderson and I had been in the job. We were old friends in a way, and so probably I had more of a run-in with him than Henderson did, but he never fit into the program, and he also managed to annoy and alienate an awful lot of people. Partly because he was given the job of affirmative action, which wasn't a popular idea, and since he was black and so on, he had very strong feelings about it, and he used to really badger people. About all sorts of things. So I think an awful lot of department chairs and other people were made unhappy by him. Whether it was inevitable or whether it was Jim, I don't know. But anyway, the facts were such. He got along best with Jerry, but not terribly. That was not a terribly close relationship. So it proved to be not a terribly happy ship after Jack died. For quite a while. And then Jerry began quarreling particularly with Bruce Carpenter, who was a new appointment as an associate vice president to take care of personnel. The school became sort of a matter, and that spread into a quarrel with the president. then Jerry got into a big fight with the French department over its chair, Lindsay Thomas. That was a big brawl. There were also problems with promotion. This was still a period when there were limitations by quota on promotion. And so there were various frictions and troubles and so on. And Jerry decided to resign after 2 years. And so then we were back to the old business, do I run for dean? I think it was only to be acting dean. I don't think there was the idea of, I don't know whether we were going to get another outsider, and if we were going to look at insiders, they could only be acting deans. And it seems to me the prospect was only always to be acting. I don't think it was ever a dean. And having been in the race twice before, I guess I said, oh, what the hell, and ran again. My understanding is that Hayden also was a candidate for acting dean at that point to return, and that the other candidate was Asher. And I have this at second and third hand, and I don't really know, but my understanding is the president wasn't terribly happy with any of us. And so he never could bring himself to make an appointment. And finally, very late in the day, probably in August or late July or August in the summer, he finally said to Goodman Malamut, well, you make the appointment. I don't like any of the candidates I've been given. So Goodman Malamut, I guess, decided to appoint me. He told me that this was likely to happen, but he didn't know where the president was going to go along with it. And I went off on vacation. It was then mid-August or something like that. And I finally, I guess, got the formal notification by telephone call again, one of these long-distance calls. I'd forgotten where this one was from. When I came back, and it was about a week till school started, Henderson was scheduled to leave the associate deanship, and we had a search to replace him, and various people had been recommended. So I had this report of the search committee. My job was vacant, not to be filled. And I decided that I was not going to be dean and try to work with Jim Robinson, because we never got along, and I figured it wouldn't work, and there's no use trying. And delicate matters like personnel, you need somebody that you really have complete confidence in and you really feel very safe with. I just didn't have that. So I declared that my authority was to remake all the associate deans, since I'd have to live with them and try to make the thing go. Told him that I want someone else. Without a committee or anything to advise me, I had two positions to fill and a couple days to fill it. So I asked Doc Goldish to be associate dean, because I'd worked with her as chairman of the committee, the curriculum committee, and I thought she was a very, very competent person. She'd do the job very well. I took Bill Resch as the associate dean and for fiscal affairs. He was a statistician, and I thought he had a lot of basic competencies that would be required in manipulating all the statistics and whatnot we worked with. In that sense, he could pick up the job, which I didn't think anybody could easily pick up, not having seen it at close hand. And then I cast about for somebody to me take Jim Robinson's place. And I'd gotten to know Charlie Austin a little as chairman of the math department, because each of the associate deans worked with each department chairman. And then they had an appeal to the dean or to the council if they didn't like what the associate deans were up to. So we got to know all the departments here very well. I think you've been chair for some time. I was really impressed by him. I thought he was an able guy. So I talked him into taking the job as associate dean. And I remember having to go to the first meeting of the faculty, and the president had everybody, and he made a big speech, and then the schools broke up and went various places, and the only place where letters and science could meet, essentially, was, you know, in a big room like we were, so we always used to stay. The other schools would leave, and letters and science would stay. And then I had this big faculty, and I had the job of announcing that I'd really shuffled all the associate deans, two of them without any advice from anybody. I thought, well, gee, I'm going to get in some trouble with this. But everybody had enough run-ins with Jim, so they were glad, that part of it, and then they accepted the rest. So you know, I'd created a balance again, and I had people from various areas. So and I must say that I think it was as good a team of people as could have been put together. I really enjoyed working with those people. Charlie Austin is, in my mind, a very fine gentleman, a first-rate person. One of my favorite people next to Iden, as a matter of fact, was an individual. And Bob Henderson, of course, I would have kept dearly, you know, dearly loved to keep, but he was determined to go. I didn't know Bill Rush terribly well. But Bill proved to be, you know, an interesting appointment. Really, truly a remarkable guy. Recites Kipling by the hour, and really is kind of a ham actor, and widely read and outside of statistics, which is his field. And interesting man. I had a lot of fun with Bill. So it was a good team. We got along very well together. Somehow I launched in this business of being the acting dean of letters and sciences. One of the first jobs I had was really kind of interesting. Rod Peck, who was in Extension, had developed the notion, which was true, that the president and the deans were not getting on terribly well, and that there wasn't really an articulate relationship such as there should have been, and that we should have a retreat where we'd all get together and talk these things out. There were two new deans that had been appointed. Brevar was in fine arts at this time, Tyndall having moved to planning. And Bowman had come aboard in business. So we had a retreat out here in Huntington Beach or, you know, someplace. I can't remember where this was, the one that was in Huntington Beach. We had one of them that was at Cal Poly Pomona, in that center. Anyway, one of my first assignments was to write an essay on how one is a dean. And to hand this in as part of the general exercise. So, this meeting must have been up at Pomona. I don't remember a hell of a lot about the meeting. Except the president proposed doing something. I forgot what. He was going to redo the faculty constitution, which he didn't approve of. Tear it up. Start over. I remember making a speech saying that that was a very unwise thing to do. But if he really quarreled with a particular point in the Constitution, he should focus on that point, but not tear it up. I said, the picture of the president of the university tearing up the faculty's Constitution, it ain't going to fly. You know, it just is not a good image for you to have. And surprisingly, Dave Gray, said, Dick's absolutely right. You know, President Hornet wouldn't do that under any circumstance. So this one confrontation head on. The rest of it, I tried to sit in the background and not let the other people do the talking, because I I knew the president hadn't favored my appointment particularly, and the GM had let me know that pretty plainly. I figured, well, I'm going to have a hard time making this thing go, with the president really not being favorable, and with the president being angry at the School of Letters and Science because he was so angry at Jerry before. And Carpenter had been angry, so our personnel decisions tended to be all redone when they got up at the higher level rather than, so how in the hell do you make this thing fly? That was one of the problems that I faced. So I decided I would lay low except on this one point, so I kind of remember it. I don't think anything terribly constructive came out of all that. We had some good food. We played poker. That's the first time I played poker with my deanly colleagues and administrators, and Carpenter and all the rest. Most of them were better poker players than I was. I hadn't played much poker before. So I remember that meeting pretty decisively. At this particular time, the president didn't really raise the question of breaking up the School of Arts and Sciences, though I think he had it in mind. As I recall, sometime during the year, he had Goodman Malamuth, who was academic vice president, tell me that one of my jobs would be to break up the School of Letters and Sciences into three parts. And I said I didn't favor it. And like Winston Churchill, I wanted to preside over the dissolution of the British Empire. I mean, if they really wanted that done, they'd really have to find somebody else, and I'd oppose it for reasons I thought were adequate and good. I think it was good for the liberal arts on campus. I thought they'd be weakened by it. And they were already not in a tenuous position because the university was so strongly professional and applied-oriented already. They needed all the buttressing they could get. So I didn't take the hint. I didn't do anything about that. One of the most fearful things that I faced was the business of personnel. There were over 600 faculty positions, and all the staff positions that were associated with it. So it was an enormous budget and all the rest, but a lot of this was formula run and created mechanisms for running it, so I wasn't impressed by the fact that I was administering millions of dollars, which I really was. But the personnel matters, the dean had to make a decision about, make a recommendation on. So that was really one of the most important areas as I saw it. And I also felt that I had to try to reestablish some sort of working relations with the central administration. I figured, well, I'm not going to quarrel with the president. I'm not going to quarrel with Carpenter or anybody else if I can possibly avoid it. I also decided that I would have meetings every 2 weeks or every month. I've forgotten what I started out as a month and went to 2 weeks or what I did with the department chair. And they would become a major factor in the effort to bring about a more cohesive school. Otherwise, we continued to operate. A great deal of autonomy really existed in each one of the offices. I worked most closely with Charlie Austin because any personnel problems tended ultimately to worry the dean. My general philosophy was to try to get them solved at the department level. Can't get them solved there, let Charlie do it. If he can't do it, well, then they have various recourse to committees or they can appeal to me. But let's have a try at each one of these levels. So by the time it got to me, it would be sorted through by a lot of other people and I would be able to keep a reasonable distance because you can get in more trouble more quickly on personnel than any other matter. So I felt like it's good. Try to do it at these levels. So Charlie's very good, and he really fielded most of the hard stuff. So not all that much came to me. I really didn't come out too badly. I did have one problem, which I inherited from Jerry, and that was this fight with Lindsay Thomas in the French department. Well, they'd been put into receivership, and Dot Golish had been put in charge of them. And so she governed it. We were friends because she was on the curriculum for me, and she used to tell me some of these stories. I shouldn't know I'd become dean, of course, but it wouldn't have mattered, I suppose. But it was a fantastic experience. Six or seven people quarreling like cats every time they got in the same room. Well, anyway, I decided, the hell with this noise. The faculty doesn't believe in receiverships. They don't believe in outside chairs. They believe the department should manage their own affairs. So I picked somebody I thought that might conceive it would be acceptable in the department. Called him in, Fred Swenson, and said, I'm going to give you a chance to manage your own affairs. If I don't hear from you, if things are reasonably quiet and things are managed, you're on and you're going. I'll appoint you tentatively and temporarily, and it'll go and it'll go. So that proved to be successful. I got out from under the one really outstanding issue that was a center of controversy and quarrel. But I was faced with all these personnel decisions, something in the neighborhood of 150 or so. I don't know, maybe more. Reappointments, retention, tenure, but mostly promotion. I got one great blessing. They took the quotas off. So it was absolutely open season. We could promote as many as we wanted. Well, that had its advantages and it had its disadvantages, because anybody you said no to now, you couldn't say, well, there's a quota. You'd have to say no on the merits. So that was a lot more difficult. Nobody likes to be told on the merits. They get angry enough if they're told on the quota, you couldn't let you in. But on the merits, you're not worth it. That very hard on their psyches. That was not easy to do. Well, I felt we needed to get better documents, better processes in RNA. I mustn't quarrel with Carpenter. I have to establish relations with him that were reasonable, and so on. And I knew the president probably would be laying for me, in the sense that if I made a lot of personnel mistakes, well, he'd be pretty quick to pick them up. And Carpenter told me as much. He said he doesn't think that you can possibly know enough about all those people to make intelligent decisions about them. I thought, well, now we'll see what we can do. So I created a form that I used when I read the RNA folders of everybody, and I wrote all sorts of information and notes on each candidate. So I had a slip on every personnel decision I was to make. And I decided to initiate the process by which I would make a positive recommendation and send a letter of commendation to everybody I would recommend, and do some other things like that. And we also issued some guidelines on how RNA should go. And I think probably helped get things on a more even keel in the school. And when they finally came time for the decisions, well, I sat down with Bruce Carpenter, and he'd also read all the folders, and we compared our evaluations. And we sort of worked out where we stood, and I found that we didn't differ all that much. He was not as unreasonable as Jerry led me to believe. Then I had to have my great interview with the president. The president really decided, so all these folders into the president, and he would look them over, presumably, and he would say, well, it's, what do you recommend, Carpenter? What do you recommend, Andy? And so on. Then he began probing. So you recommend this, why? Got out my notes. I gave him a little lecture. So almost anybody who pulled out of the hat, I could give him a 5-minute talk on, because I'd taken my notes. And it was successful. I think I was perhaps less overruled than any of the other deans. I don't know if my judgment was good, but I had a system that he found it not too easy to cope with. I'd done my homework very carefully, and I spent a lot of time at it. That really was one of the big jobs, of course, of being dean. And I probably became more deeply involved, partly because the president began increasingly to insist that there be independent recommendations through the administrative channel, which would be parallel to the, which became a center of great controversy. And we had a new promotion document, and we got a new big argument about whether department chairs made separate recommendations, and so on. I'd become much more formally now a separate line of recommendation. The deans all had become. They began to devolve upon the dean's job of writing appointment letters. They gave us a job of making all the part-time appointments, which used to be handled centrally. So we had a separate mechanism to do that. So a lot of things happened, you know, that made the dean and the dean's office a lot more busy and a lot more weighty than perhaps it had been. So this is roughly speaking where we went in the school. The only other thing in the history of the school, I guess it's important, is that we continue to evolve RNA documented process documents, and these, some of them, like the process document, were simply taken over by the university and our university policy. So apparently they had some force and logic behind them or something anyway. So in this case, I kind of wrote things and said to people, is it all right, and passed it around, and people accepted it. And so I was in my own job of drafting documents as I used to for committees and kind of selling them to people and getting them accepted. But anyway, I feel that was successful. I think we began to define more carefully what standards we were looking for in promotion. We began to say what kind of documentation, what kind of evidence is acceptable, what kind of evaluations we expected to be done at the department level to be convincing, and trying to make the whole thing a lot more professional and a lot more like I thought universities normally function than we had in the past. I think we made some progress on all those things. My objective was to encourage research and encourage scholarly activity, but not so suddenly as to cause a great revolution. I think that's where Adam Mandy and some people went wrong. They tried to do too much too fast, tried to elevate the standards from here to there in one big jump. It can't be done that fast. But anyway, I think we were moving. I think we were moving in the right direction. So I think in those respects we were quite successful. Otherwise, curriculum went on pretty much in the patterns that had been established. Dot Golder simply picked up what she learned as part of the curriculum committee. She then very efficiently managed that office, did a very good job of it. But I don't think anything radically changed. There were no new large-scale innovations. I think most of the things that were in place were continued in place. Gresh made some innovations in reshuffling funds to change some things. He was trying some new things, the details of which I can't remember without scraping my memory pretty hard. But the second year of the school, of course, of Letters and Sciences began again with a faculty with a dean's retreat. This time, I think it was in Huntington Beach, at the one of the inns down there. And the thing that stands out in my mind was the president insisted that all the deans put their minds to work and create some guidelines for a reform of general education, which was going to be our big project for the coming year. I think the president talked about it earlier, but this is really going to do it. He turned to me, probably the busiest of all the deans in terms of the amount I care, you know.
Well, you had the largest school.
Yeah. I think that's probably true. He said, you will be in charge of the university program for reforming general education. What am I to say? I can't do it. School's so big, I got more to do. Because at the same meeting, the president was saying the school was too big and it was going to be broken up. And he was following through on what GM had said. And he really became very, very pointed about all this. Well, I was annoyed. I didn't think this was the proper channel. He never brought me in and talked to me about it. But out of the blue, he comes out in this dean's retreat. And I was really annoyed. And I lit into him. And defended the school rather rigorously. I remember Tom Dean walked down the meeting with me. He said, "That was as sharp a counterattack as I've ever seen, old boy." He said, "That was pretty good." I thought I was pretty good, too. I think the president was moved, except probably annoyed. But he leaned very hard on me, and the school had to be broken up that meeting. And I was very annoyed with the way he'd been managed. But this was to be the, you know, the big issue now. The president was determined to break off natural science and ultimately to break the others up too. And he found in Roger Bauer somebody who was a believer in that same cause. And Roger worked with the sciences to develop such a movement. And the science people, by a majority, not overwhelming, but by a majority, were for it. Several departments stronger than others. And so that was the process. So he called meetings at which he had groups of department chairs in, and I sat at one end of the table, and he sat on the other end. We used to meet in the old conference room, now the education conference room, around that sort of egg-shaped table he has up there. I sat on one end, he sat on the other, and he had groups of chairs in between, and pulled and picked and so on to try to create as much disunity and break the thing up in every conceivable way. I'd sit at the other end and try to counter him, and it was something. The school council, by and large, was opposed, of course, to being broken. The faculty, by and large, was overwhelmingly opposed, except for that group in science, which was probably a majority in science, but not a large one. So we fired our defiances and our documents back and forth to no avail. I mean, prevailed by administrative fiat in the end, and of course the science people voted by a majority to separate, and that was that. A lot of the science people came to me, and they said they were sad, but I was a good fellow, and it was nothing personal. It was just, you know, their professional judgment. They were very apologetic, some of them, very, very nice. I don't think it was anything personal. I don't know. I don't think it was. But the president's leverage and Roger working, and some of the old spirit reviving, they were really an elite in the group, but they would do better by themselves. They do better budget sense, they were encouraged to be. All these things operated, and so there it was. And that was the first of the breaks. And the question was whether we could maintain, the rump could be maintained. And it's also painful. I think I've put a lot of it out of my mind. If I were to try to run down the steps one by one, I'd really have to go back and look at the documents. I've got files on this, and the story can be deduced from those files, but I found it a very unhappy experience. And it was one of I really did think it was a mistake. But I was unable to stand in the way, and eventually I decided the president was going to prevail, and so we would try to part peacefully and try to manage. And so we ended up by trying to divide letters into two pieces with as much amiability as we could. I presided over the liquidation of that which I'd never wanted to liquidate. And I didn't have any option. Well,
what about the academic vice presidents that you worked with? Or were they influential enough on the school to bother?
Well, the academic vice president personnel was a key position, because they recommended on all personnel matters, and they gave clearance, and they were the focal point of affirmative action and everything else. So, I said I went to a lot of trouble to work out reasonable relationship with Ruth Carpenter, because of that. And then when he left to go to Macomb, Illinois, and June Cooper took over, I'd known June as a department head in communicative disorders. So we got along very well. I got along very well with June. I think our views of things were more likely to coincide than either of our views often coincided with Horne's. So we got along fine. I think even Carpenter eventually got to the point where he felt that he couldn't work easily with Horne. I don't know what the problems were. But I had good relations with them. I never had terribly good relations with Bob Tindall. I always felt that he wielded a great influence in budget and allocation of resources. I always felt that he didn't do fairly by the school letters of science, but that may have been a jaundiced view. It always seemed that we fooled around with various processes of one kind and another, and all of us was game playing, and then eventually he'd make a recommendation to the president, and that's the way it would happen, and I got kind of annoyed with that whole process. So I didn't get along well with Tindall. We got along all right when we were together in sort of deanly levels, but we got along well with him after that. Tindall was not one of my favorite people, and I didn't get on with him, but he's the only one at the university level that I personally, had any great difficulties with. I don't see we fought particularly. I just felt that he was not a favorable influence, and that we ended up with less than we should, because he recommended it year in and year out, and I couldn't help but, I'm sure, show that. I even wrote to the president complaining on some occasions and making counter-arguments of various sorts. I'm sure these were shared with him, so he knew that we were not getting on. The other associate vice presidency, which now exists, has got an interesting history. One of my arguments, of course, against the breakup of the School of Letters and Sciences had always been that it would weaken the liberal arts, that there should be a liberal arts core to the university and professional schools. This is the way universities are normally organized, and I didn't see a reason why our organization should depart from it, and that the liberal arts and sciences were going to be in for buffeting by the general trends of society and they were going to, and all the other things that were happening, and they needed to be bolstered. The president said, "I agree with you. I mean, I'm a liberal arts man, and I'm all for liberal arts." I said, "Well, if you are, your mechanism of administration is going to have to reinforce it, because it won't stand by itself. If you break it up into pieces, it's going to be weakened. And you're going to, if your real purpose is to maintain a strong liberal arts program on this campus, you're not contributing to it by breaking up the School of Arts and Science." My counter plan was to, for a long time, Goodwin Malamuth had thought that he had too many things to do. And he'd shed the personnel matters off onto Bruce Carpenter, and now he wanted to shed a lot of other matters, special programs, honors, audiovisual, a lot of things that he had a fret with. He wanted to shed them off on another vice president. Rather than have to worry about all these things himself. And I sympathize with him to some degree. So they were talking about creating an associate vice president. This was OGM's idea, and this is what he wanted to do with the job. Well, I suggested that what they should do was take this job and use the associate vice president to be what I'd call a super dean, and then create three schools, but keep a coordination in what would be a associate vice president for the liberal arts. And you use the office in that way. Well, there were lots of problems with that. You could see from the rest of the university's point of view, they wouldn't be happy with it. And The president would never use it in that way. He wouldn't. He said that just interposes another level of administration between the letters and science and the deans and the central administration and the rest of it. So we pointed out that at Berkeley they just split in the same way, and they created an associate vice president for professional schools and one for liberal arts. So maybe he should think maybe about that, but he didn't like that idea either. And neither did Leo Goodman Malamuth, of course, who had his own ideas. So we ended up by creating an associate vice president to do a lot of the things that Leo wanted to do. And the president put off on it the business of general education, because that was his big deal. And he said, now I've got somebody I can make the real honcho for general education. Will he, having been not too successful at it? I was busy, and it wasn't my first priority. But I did some things, and I had some ideas in spite of everybody, but there you are. So that's how that position was created. And it was also given the job of coordinating the liberal arts. So if you looked at the original job description, it had all the things that Leo wanted to put in the office, like administering special programs and all that sort of thing, and audiovisual and various other things, the GE project, and then the coordination of liberal arts. And so they simply said, well, we'll have a creative coordinator. So that was the genesis of that position, which was a strange one.